So thank you, Dr. Walton. I think I'd like to invite the panelists, the speakers, to come and sit at the table for questions. We have approximately 15 minutes, and I'm checking the watch, so we won't go over. Else Dr. Pai could be mad at me. So are there any questions in the audience? And I'm visually challenged, so you might have to jump up and down. Yes, there's a hand there. And I don't know where the microphone is. Or you could get up to the mic, I suppose. Might be easier. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Marilyn Ehun, and I'm a student here at McGill graduating in psychology this semester. I want to thank all the panels for your great talks. And my question is directed specifically at Dr. Fuhrer. I really appreciated your talk on mental disorders, and coming from a psychology background, that's kind of my focus. And I'm wondering how in the department you're preparing MSc, PhD students for work in mental health at a population level.
Okay. Interesting question. So the program is quite new, mm-hmm. and we there are the standard our students take the same epidemiology and biostatistics. So our program is heavily grounded in epi and biostatistics like the MSc and epi. The students at the then have the public health disciplines that they can take. Those who are interested in mental health in particular, whether it's health services or something different, some of the examples I can choose their electives, and so some do have taken courses in the psychology department. Some actually have come in with an undergraduate degree in psychology or neuroscience, because that's what sometimes it's called now. Like yourself, my undergraduate degree was in psychology. And so are we specifically focusing on mental health? No, because within the we consider the master's a public health program, more of a generalist program, and there's room for individual students to specialize, but we haven't focused that in particular.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other question? Is this a postprandial sleepiness? Yes.
Please go ahead.
Postprandial.
Brief question. I read a statistic in the U.S. that life expectancy at 60 or 65 for blue-collar workers compared to white-collar are very bad. And the experience of aging is very bad.
Okay, so the question was about life expectancy amongst like different occupational classes, I guess was your point.
And
okay, and socioeconomic status. My goal in you know, the study that we're doing is actually to move forward that kind of information rather than there's a lot of information that's already available, but it's not collected with all of the other context of aging, and I think for our study what we're trying to do is to take that information and then collect all the other information, because I think it's not sufficient, and you know, Jay can obviously speak, it's not sufficient just to categorize people according to their occupational status and say that that is a cause of a shorter life expectancy. There's a lot more going on, so my view is that you need to collect more information to better establish what it is, because it could be certain exposures rather than just being a blue-collar worker. It's just a proxy, I suspect. I don't know if that sort of touches on your question.
Dr. Kaufman, no?
We've done a number of descriptive studies about these trends between socioeconomic groups across time. In mortality and in specific outcomes, in birth outcomes, in cognitive decline, and in a number of other health outcomes. And there are a number of different issues that arise. One is that, you know, people change their position over their life course, so you have some issues of reverse causality. The other thing that happens in comparisons across time is that the composition of those groups changes over time. So blue-collar workers is a category that has a very different meaning now than it used to have 30 years ago in terms of what the social characteristics of the group were. And that's true also for education categories, for example. So there are many interesting issues that arise. It's not a simple endeavor, but we're certainly very interested in those questions, and we publish a lot of work investigating those kinds of trends.
I'd just like to had a brief point. I don't know if this one's okay. I've had the opportunity to work with several cohorts, both in the UK and in France, who have looked at aging and indeed have found, but as Dr. Wilson just said, it's a marker for many other factors. And you're talking about blue-collar workers in adulthood. The title of this panel was about lifespan or life course, and it's also where people start and not just where they end up before they die. So that complicates the issue further, but I think it's important to keep that in mind. Yeah.
There's a question?
Question over there.
There's a question there.
There's a microphone.
Dr. Hanley, could you use the microphone, please? It's just next to you. Thank you.
I think to start studying me at my age is too late. Even to start me studying me at 45 is probably too late. Half of one's life and half of one's exposure has already been laid down, half of one's life experience. And I have a feeling now in cancer and some of the other areas that even though we discuss what you're doing now, and in Framingham we were discussing your cholesterol levels when you were 45, they're now finding out in Framingham they have the equivalent of pack years. Pack years was a fine one to figure out what your smoking exposure was over your years. They're now doing cholesterol years, high cholesterol years. And they missed that point for years and years and years because they didn't start watching cholesterol at age 20 or 15. So I'm wondering how much you're probably missing half the story. You're starting them when? In most of these aging studies, people start at what, 40, 45?
Most 50? Of the aging
when are you
studies
starting?
On aging start around about 65, actually.
Yeah,
and only in recent years, people have gone further back. I mean, ideally, birth cohorts are where we should start.
Exactly.
There's not enough time for me
I know.
To start and publish anything.
But we could stagger them a little bit. But I am making a plea, I guess, for starting early. And it was the cholesterol one that really floored me.
Yeah.
That people thought the cholesterol was fine and the logistic regression, but when people were able to look at the offspring, they could actually look at cholesterols from 20 years onwards. And it's a major change in how we might treat cholesterol even today.
But I think, your point also speaks to not only how to, what is the age to begin the cohort, but what to collect.
Exactly.
Because, you cannot, from my own personal experience, you cannot bring in someone for 3 days of testing in order to collect everything you might possibly want to have in the future.
Yeah.
So that's a challenge. I don't know, Mike, do you have any comments about birth cohorts in Canada or possibly?
Yeah, I mean, it's not just pack years, Jim. I mean, if you believe the DOHAD philosophy about the developmental origins of health and disease, the exposures that you have in utero or in some cases even that your mother had preconceptionally can have long-standing impacts of and beyond, well beyond the amount of time that the exposure actually occurred. So, and this is related to some of the comments that were made this morning about epigenetics. I think it's been a little bit oversold, frankly, but there are the same exposure during fetal life is not necessarily the same as during infancy, during childhood, or during middle age or older age. So.
Other questions? Yes.
Tom Lewis, I hesitate to ask this because I can ask it in 30 seconds and it would take several weeks to discuss, but I'll do it anyway. We have four great presentations on four training programs and research programs at McGill, and even just a little tidbit and what you see is the future of educating the next generation in your four areas would be good. I know it's the whole rest of the week we could spend on it, but even a little snippet would be nice.
Are you asking what we would suggest to be included in a program, or what are the key features that are important in it to do our own particular type of research?
Well, I'm thinking actually you could pick anything, but even more, 5 years from now, do you think we'll be delivering education the same way we have, and in what areas might we have radically changed just what programs look like, let alone what the content is? And that's why I hesitate to ask, because
I could get into
we spend every faculty meeting on this almost the whole time.
I'm going to just go out there that I think one of the things that we really need to ensure that we do is we need to train trainees on how to design studies and how to actually collect data from live, intact human beings. Because I think that's a place where we are not necessarily, and I'm not just talking about our department, I think there are a lot of departments that are struggling with how can you create an environment where students can actually collect data and still finish a PhD in a reasonable period of time or still finish a master's. So that's the one, if I could just answer, give one, that would be my one.
Okay, so I'm going to answer a little bit differently. I totally agree with what you just said. I think I was trying to make the point that we don't do enough work in an area that is so important from a population and public health perspective. One great hope that I have for the future is the new chair of psychiatry actually has a PhD in epidemiology, and that we have had very few people come and train in the department from the fields of mental health, and that by perhaps some joint recruitments for the future, that we can help develop and enhance the methodological rigor that we're known for by working collaboratively, which we've seen when I was showing some of the other themes that people work on, topics. It's because we have trained people who have now gone out and are doing those research, but they have the right kind of training and they work collaboratively in an interdisciplinary fashion. So, and I think that there's that openness now, when I gave that example of the Access Project that's being led out of the Douglas, again, where the head of the project is very much an epidemiologist at the same time, without the skill set that somebody would get from the department. So that's my wishful thinking.
I guess I'll add.
Was that on? Yeah. I guess I'll add two other quick ideas. One is maybe redundant with my talk, but the idea of causal inference as an organizing principle for teaching in public health research. We have a course in causal inference at the doctoral level that we offer, but we've recently been talking about the idea of getting rid of it because it seems inappropriate to ghettoize the topic in a single course when, in fact, every single course should be about causal inference. So integrating those ideas into all the coursework has been one of our ongoing struggles or one of our ongoing projects. And the other is to make the coursework much more hands-on. We felt like we had a lot of courses in which we talked about confounding, we talked about selection bias, we talked about these things in kind of theoretical terms, but we tried to make much more of an effort to actually have hands-on assignments where people are working on projects with data to gain familiarity with programming and with manipulating data to understand it in much more hands-on terms as opposed to just theoretical terms. So those are, I mean, maybe those are very generic kinds of comments, but they're the kinds of things that we're trying to make progress in on a day-to-day basis to evolve the curriculum so that it's more useful for people.
And I'll have a different kind of answer, and that is, I think the strength of this department has always been in the methods training, and I think one of the advantages, but also disadvantages, of being a department in a medical school and not a school of public health is that we really can't afford the luxury of hiring cancer epidemiologists and cardiovascular epidemiologists or even mental health epidemiologists. That strength, I mean, is illustrated to me. I was away for 10 years exactly between the time I was at CIHR and the year that I spent on sabbatical, and I had no contact with the PhD students in our department during that 10-year period, and I was on the PhD comprehensive exam committee for many years before I left, and I'm now seeing the PhD students who are defending their PhD thesis protocols, and I can tell you that it is like night and day. I felt like I was, knew more than most of the PhD students 10 years ago, and now it's absolutely the reverse. So that's just a 10-year period. I don't know what the future holds. It could be my Alzheimer's. Thank you, Jay. But I like to think that it's actually there. So I think that shows how much the methods have moved in 10 years, either mine or theirs. I would say the one downside of this is I sometimes get the impression, which I didn't get more than 10 years ago now, that sometimes the methods, the objective becomes to use the new methods rather than answer an important question. And I think we probably could use some help in the future about refocusing on important questions and then using the methods that are necessary to answer those questions.
So on that, I would like to thank the speakers and invite you to break, and we should reconvene here at 15:30. Thank you very much.